towards Bill for contributions that he has made to my own research career. I was neither a student nor a collaborator of Dan over the years, of Bill over the years, and we overlapped at University of Minnesota for a couple years. I was in grad school there, and as it turns out, that was a fortuitous meeting because I was entirely plant-focused at the time and had some associations with Bill directly and with the people in his lab that opened my eyes to insects as consumers of plants and how interesting the system of chemical ecology of plant-herbivore interactions could be. So thank you for that, that pointed me in that direction. Okay, that statement at the top of the slide has now become pretty much a truism. In one form or another, it becomes the introduction to our grant proposals, our papers, our talks. Okay, but it wasn't always the case. And in the very early days of plant-herbivore interactions, back in the late 60s, when Bill started publishing his work, we thought of plant chemistry as simply what insects cued in on to know that it's the food they can eat. Okay, it was considered a fairly static system. And over the intervening almost 40 years now, we've learned that when insects feed on plant, they influence plant chemistry, which has feedback effects on insect growth and performance, and we presume evolution. Some phylogenetic patterns suggest so. And we also now know there are a whole bunch of indirect effects that are mediated by plant chemistry. Now, this is a highly simplified view, and from many of the speakers preceding me in this symposium, you've heard many more details about the kinds of indirect interactions that occur via plant chemistry in plant-herbivore interaction. Now, Bill, in his own career, has slid back and forth along that chemistry scale, or on a continuum running between plants and insects, okay, in his own work. And so is my own, and I originally started up more on the insect side, and my PhD thesis was one on nutritional ecology of caterpillars, taking into account water and nitrogen, inspired by the Matson and Matson and Scriber papers. But I was trained as a botanist, and so I migrated back to plants, and they have spent the last 20 years in a fairly intense collaboration in several senses with Jack Schultz, and I'm going to describe to you today three little vignettes of research that have been influenced a lot by Bill's contributions to plant herbivore interactions over the years. By the way, Bill, Jack sends his congratulations. He thinks and we both wish you, let's see, longevity in good health and happiness of working only as much as you want.
Okay.
Our joint lab has been interested for almost the last 20 years in how plants identify attackers and mount the appropriate defenses, how they mobilize those resources for defenses, and how plants are manipulated by galling insects. And this last one is a project that we've returned to after a lapse of many years, and I'll conclude with explanation of new results there. Okay, we want to know, can plants tell insects apart? We know insects can tell plants apart, right? They choose their hosts, sometimes with great fidelity, sometimes less. But can plants tell insects apart? And the obvious response is, well, yes, of course, they can tell when they're being sucked or when they're being chewed, okay? But they actually distinguish those differences on a much finer level. And we want to know how they do that. Now, I started studying plant-insect interactions on these giants, magnificent giants, and we quickly identified a pair of caterpillars feeding on those plants to which oaks responded very differently. When gypsy moths chewed on oaks, they elicited a very different tannin profile than when forest tent caterpillars chewed on those, right? And the plant physiologist in me wanted to know how that works. How does the plant see these as different? Well, oak is not a good model system for that. It's not a very powerful genetic resource. So I switched from this giant to this one. And this one also has chemical defenses. This is Arabidopsis thaliana, the model, one of several model plant systems now, fortunately. And it too, yes, has herbivores. And there's also a pair of caterpillars on Arabidopsis that elicit very different chemistry defense profiles. In this case, the defenses are glucosinolates. These are the sulfur and nitrogen containing compounds that make your mustard taste spicy, that confer the health benefits of broccoli. Right, and they're fairly straightforward to measure by liquid chromatography. Okay, there are, sorry about the alignment here. There are two caterpillars, very different effects on the plants. On the left-hand panel is a stacked bar graph of different glucosinolates found in Arabidopsis. Here's your control plant. When Spadoptera exigua feeds on that, you get about a 40% increase in glucosinolates. Just look at the totals of on the bars. When Pieris brassicae feeds, or rape, either one feeds on them, they elicit no response. Okay, that's after several days of feeding. If you look over even shorter periods of time, after several hours of feeding, here's glucosinolate data presented in a different way. Let's find the pointer. There we go. Okay, the individual glucosinolates listed here. This is essentially a heat map with red being a larger amount of those glucosinolates compared to a control, and blue being a lower amount. If you look at short term, you even see a decrease in accumulation of those defenses. Why, that's curious. Why is the plant responding so differently to these two caterpillars? Now, I think it was Mark who mentioned saliva, right? Insect saliva is deposited on plants, and that was initially what we thought would be the obvious difference between them. But we haven't pursued that path directly, because as a botanist, I thought, well, actually the plant has a complex response to these herbivores. If I hold the mirror up to the plant, it can give me that complex answer, okay? Because I'm really interested in how the plant responds, and if there's something different in the saliva or something else that the insect does, we can then, once we understand the plant point of view, go back and examine what the insect is providing to elicit that response. Well, clearly, Pieris is doing something to either avoid recognition at all by the plant or block the plant's normal response if it is recognized, right? Comprising some sort of stealth in its feeding on Arabidopsis. Okay, to understand how the plant is responding to these differently, we have to look at the series of events that occurs in a very general sense when insect bites plant. We know the wounding, the plants wound, they remove tissue, they crush, they leave a crushed tissue edge, and they may or may not deposit elicitors. Recent work by Gary Felton's lab suggests that we're down in the picomolar range of spit that's actually deposited. So I'm beginning to think there may be something there, but it's going to be a very strong signal in very small amounts. And I'll get to that part in another 5 years. Okay, the plants obviously perceive that damage somehow. The biology of plant receptors is still in the dark ages. There are about six of them that have receptor-like kinases that have been characterized. Most of them are hormone receptors. They don't really provide any answers for us yet. Then there's a signaling cascade downstream of whatever the perception moment is that involves MAP kinases, transcription factors, and hormones. And that is really a black box right now, even in the best known plants. But we know pieces of the story, but we don't have a complete story for responses to pathogens, drought, et cetera, other kinds of stresses. Those signaling pathways end up in differential expression of defense genes, which then, of course, result in changes in defense chemistry, which then feeds back to the insect and can alter insect behavior and performance if it chooses to remain on that leaf or on that plant in the case of systemic induction. Well, the caterpillar could be mucking with things at any of these levels, right? Perception, signaling, or defense gene expression. And we figured that the most efficient way to try to characterize the plant response was to do some global expression profiling. which of course is one of the reasons you go to a boring model plant to do your work, because these kinds of things are possible. And so we've taken two approaches. One is array profiling, and the other, which I'll show you in a moment, and the other approach is to take advantage of the many mutants that have been developed in Arabidopsis. These are plants that have mutations in specific pieces of those signaling pathways. And you can screen insect responses to those mutants to tell you whether that particular gene, at least as disabled in that mutant, is important to the plant's response to that specific insect. And that's done with a series of rapid throughput phenotyping. I'll show you. Okay, arrays. As an ecologist, I was used to lots of data, right? Be careful what you wish for. All right, in this array study, it ended up with 3,000 differentially expressed genes in treatments that involved two different caterpillars, two different aphids of wounding, two different time points, and local versus, locally damaged tissue and undamaged tissue to evaluate systemic responses. And they tell you that we have a sequenced genome in Arabidopsis. It is, and it's pretty well annotated for any genome, but over half of the differentially expressed genes were in an unknown function category. So it's been a really interesting, and at times exciting, at times boring, process wading through the expression profiles. Let me show you some major patterns, though, that emerged. Here are two aphid species, Mynthes persici, on the left, Rebicornis brachii. The caterpillars were Pieris rapi and Spadoptera exigua. Those of you who know these insects know that kind of embedded in here is a specialist generalist story, which I'm not going to go into. These graphs, the dark bars on your right show you upright, the number of upregulated genes, gray bars on the left, the number of downregulated. What I want to point out is the low amount of overlap. Now these, of each of the pairs, these are insects that are feeding on the plant in the same way. And we've controlled for developmental variation, or feeding on different parts of the plant, which is actually very important, even for small plants like Arabidopsis. We controlled that by wrangling the caterpillars so they were feeding on the same age leaf. So we've controlled for plant development, and still 10 to 20% overlap between the plant responses to the caterpillar and the plant responses, 10% less than that, in the plant responses to the aphids. Plants are good taxonomists. They're telling these insects apart. What parts of the signaling pathway that we know about in plants are plants using to do this? We use rapid throughput phenotyping to evaluate a series of mutants. And what it is we take a picture of a plant, we plop a caterpillar on, we allow it feed for some period of time, and take a picture again. And our colleagues in bioinformatics at Mizzou have developed a system in which they can digitize the green in the images before and after, and we get a lovely spreadsheet that tells us how much the insect ate. It allows us to do as many as we want to take a picture of at one time. So it really helps. And in this case, we're doing a choice assay with two different genotypes. And it would be, say, a control and a mutant with a gene disabled, for a MAP kinase. And then we would see how much of each was eaten. You can also do these with, if you want to ask, does the insect care in a no-choice experiment, how is its performance affected? Then we'll put a herbivore on here and let it run. This allows us to screen large numbers of MAP kinases, for which there are mutants, and as you'll see in a moment, some other genes that are important to specificity in plant responses. Okay, so what have we learned from this combination of studies? Well, the first thing we know is that there are clearly insect-specific signatures. Plants are taxonomous. All right, the other thing we have learned is that ethylene appears to be critical to specificity. Now, how do we know that? Well, if you end up with 3,000 differentially expressed genes, the first thing you do is go looking for the transcription factor differences, because there you know you have some master regulators of gene expression. And when we looked at those, particularly for the caterpillars, we saw that there was a class of ethylene-responsive transcription factors that were upregulated by the caterpillar that induces glucosinolates and were not by the caterpillar that fails to induce glucosinolates. So that seems circumstantial evidence that ethylene is involved, and now grad students Aaron Rarig and Clayton Kaufman are pursuing this. And I just got reports over PDA of their first ethylene measurements in these plants of Bertruna's two species, and indeed, Pieris is failing to elicit the usual ethylene burst that Spadoptera and all other herbivores usually elicit in the foliage in which they feed. So we know that something, that it's ethylene related, and we're about to screen, well, our next job will be to screen a series of ethylene mutants for its role in signaling. Some of the MAP kinases are also involved, and that MAP kinases themselves are a complex system where there are multiple of them, multiples acting in the same way. You know, rarely double mutants available, but you can, we begin to get see a picture that, first of all, they're necessary responses to insects in general, and one of them, MAPK6, may confer some specificity because of its involvement in ethylene signaling pathway. Okay, one vignette, and if anybody has more questions about that, I'd be happy to talk with you later. Next, I want to focus on another area that you just heard quite a bit about, which is how resources are provided for defense gene expression. Right, that is one thing to say, oh, the genes are turned on. It's another thing to actually garner the resources for those defenses to the site of manufacture. And this is what we call our Sphinx Project, under collaboration with Tom Arnold at Dickinson University. Here's a figure from Nabi et al. In 2008 paper showing the black area shows the actual insect damage, and the red areas are fluorescent markers for defense lignification genes that are turned on around the periphery. That damage limits local delivery of defenses, but of course, and lowers rates of photosynthesis well beyond the area of damage. Those signals have to get to the vascular system to call for the necessary defense resources to synthesize defenses. And Dan, thank you, did a very nice introduction to the system of vascular constraints on that. And we've shown in the past that the reserves from supporting vascularly connected mature leaves down here are pulled up into a damaged leaf by either insect damage or a surrogate of that using a wound hormone. Right? We've done this with stable isotope primarily. And we've learned that insect feeding and jasmonic acid induce enzymes called invertases, which offload the sucrose from the phloem. So they provide the suck, so to speak. And sources of sucrose depend on the local patterns of phloem connections. Poplars are plumbed in a particular way, so every third leaf is connected vascularly, primarily to every eighth leaf. So a handy tomato has some handy strong connections like that. Arabidopsis is a 1-3, and some plants are very reticulate, and there's very little strong connection. So it depends on the species. Okay, and then last, that the amount of sucrose offloaded depends on the pull of competing plant modules. All right, so those modules can be alternative reproductive organs, they can be below ground parts, and we've shown with poplar that the carbon is shunted pretty regularly among those modules in response to herbivory. Carbon, well, a lot of defenses are made from carbon, but there are also a lot of good defenses made from nitrogen. So we felt it was important to find out whether nitrogen moves in similar ways with similar constraints. And here's the model of poplar with the importing young sphinx and the exporting sources. And when we did a dual labeling experiment with T13 carbon and N15 applied as a soil drench, the nitrogen moved up, but it didn't move up any faster when there was, in this case, jasmonic acid to simulate damage. We've done just conducted a second insect experiment, and it doesn't appear that nitrogen is responsive to insect damage at all. So nitrogen and carbon are moving. I mean, we know they move in different tissue. I mean, nitrate's moving through the xylem, and carbon largely through the phloem, but they are not responding in the same way to damage by herbivores to support those defenses. Okay. What about competing modules? Here we generated poplar plant with multiple branches, with young leaves still on multiple branches, and we labeled the source leaves down below with carbon and found out that the carbon did not move into any of the branches. So there's a strict partitioning there where the additional carbon will not be moved up into the damage, in response to damage in those branches. Nitrogen, however, moved readily, but no more often, no more in response to the damage. So the responsiveness of carbon and nitrogen within the plant to support defense production is pretty different. We're also going to try this in Arabidopsis. A graduate student, Abby Ferrieri, there is going to do a similar set of dual labeling experiments and also include some short-term C11 work because there's evidence from other labs that there's an initial removal of carbon, outflow of carbon from damaged leaves shortly after herbivory. But when we look at over longer periods of time with this C13 isotope, it's net inflow in. So we think that some of that differences in results between labs has to do with the temporal series of labeling. All right. So we can add to this our growing understanding of the plant responses that the carbon is moved preferentially to damaged sites, but nitrogen is responding very differently. Now that may matter to an oak tree in which carbon defenses predominate, at least numerically. But when you talk about plants that have carbon and but mostly nitrogen-rich defenses, like any plant in the cabbage family, Brassicaceae, then you're seeing that the response, the ability to synthesize those defenses in response may not have any of the same constraints that we've observed in other plants. Okay, last, how are plants manipulated to make calls? We've talked about some subtleties, some stealth, some maybe some manipulation by caterpillars to avoid defenses in their host plants. Well, insect gallers are the ultimate manipulators. Insect galls seem to resemble ectopic organs, and several of you in the room have done work showing that they are strong sinks, Peter's work in particular. And that they are species and tissues specific. These are all made by a different species of cynipid wasp on oaks. And the wasp makes the same shape every time. Okay. The development is determinate. It's a specific controlled developmental process that does not occur without the insect. You pull the insect out, development stops. And galls have organized specialized tissues. I'm not going to have time to describe them all, but what we decided to do was to test the ectopic organ hypothesis with phylloxera, which is a major pest on grape, primarily the roots, although when it occurs on leaves, it can also do some damage. And this work was done by Sarah Melissa, grad student Sarah Melissa Woodyak. And we figured that if an insect is going to cause that much change in development of a plant, it has to accomplish two things. It has to tell the cell to change from a vegetative state to a reproductive state. Okay? And then it has to initiate expression of genes associated with reproduction. And in plants, they have an ABC model. It's not important. The tails are not important, but various combinations of those genes cause the formation of sepals, petals, stamens, and corpus. So what Sarah Melissa did was to use qPCR to pull those genes out of grape and say, are they different in the gall than elsewhere? Vegetative reproductive transition genes? Yep. Yep. The cells are being made competent to differentiate in a different way. What about the plant organ genes? In phylloxera galls, no sepals, no petals, no stamen genes, but yes, three of the carpal genes are upregulated in the gall compared to the adjacent leaf or an ungalled leaf. All right, so that's strong evidence that galls are maybe functionally ectopic carpals. The way you really want to prove that is to knock out the gene and show that the insect can't make the gall. That's really hard to do in grape. So I've been working up poplar, shifting over to poplar as a model system in conjunction with Tom Whittem and colleagues. not only can you transform it with RNAi, it's slower than other plants, but you have a sequenced genome, a nice QTLs for resistance, and of course a rich ecological history. So I think I've shared that plants can tell similar kinds of insects apart, an ethylene-dependent mechanism. Mobilization of carbon and nitrogen is different. And herbivores can manipulate plant responses to varying degrees, with gallers as ultimate manipulators. Now, I can't blame Bill for all this. I can thank a number of collaborators, but I can say that Bill's career could be characterized by either thinking outside the box or teaching us all that the box is much bigger than we think. And that has always encouraged me to think broader and deeper in my own research. Thanks, Bill.